This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Iraq's new constitution goes down to the wire. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International. Welcome to listeners of KSFC in Spokane, Washington. Oil, religion, and possible civil war are at stake as the U.S. pushes for Iraq's new constitution to be finished by the deadline of midnight tonight. But Sunni Arabs who ruled under Saddam Hussein fear that Kurds and Shiites are making a deal to monopolize Iraq's oil. If they're not part of the action, the Sunnis could fuel an increasingly violent insurgency for a long time to come. On To the Point, after last-minute postponements, we'll get a progress report on meeting tonight's deadline. We'll hear about federalism, the role of Islam, and the consequences for women's rights. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. Kurds, Sunnis, and Shiites are struggling to write Iraq's new constitution, with the U.S. pushing to meet the deadline of midnight tonight. On To the Point, there are sharp divisions over the role of Islam and women's rights. Could disputes about oil lead to civil war? First, this news update. Israel's pullout from the Gaza Strip has begun. Soldiers today issued eviction notices to settlers with orders to leave by Wednesday or be removed by force. Richard Myron is there for the BBC. Richard, has there been any violence?
Well, there hasn't been any violence. There has, though, been confrontations here in the main settlement of Nevada Kalim. This is the largest of the Gaza settlements. And what was meant to happen was that police and army were meant to enter into here and serve the residents here with eviction letters, which would then say they had 48 hours from midnight of last night until Tuesday night to leave their homes, and after that date they'd be removed forcibly. Now, what happened was that they came to the gates of the settlement and found it blockaded by men, women, and children. And at one point, the soldiers, about 100 soldiers, entered via another entrance into the settlement and were literally surrounded by hundreds of people who didn't use any violence but used very strong vocal force, saying things like, a Jew shouldn't expel another Jew. You are acting like anti-Semites by taking a Jew from his home, and saying, how can you do this in good conscience? There was a lot of emotional scenes, you know, a lot of the settlers and their supporters here crying, and indeed I saw a couple of soldiers also crying. I think that's a taste of things to come. There are, though, of course, concerns that there could actually be violence, because in addition to the few thousand people who live here, there are a couple of thousand people who've come in from outside, many of them highly radicalized, quite young, and I think ready, in some of them at least, for trouble or a showdown with the security forces.
Roughly how many people are there in Nevada Kalim, and how many soldiers are there to evict them?
Well, we know the total number of soldiers and security personnel involved in this is 42,000, which is an awful lot. The number of people here, it's hard to determine. It wavers according to whoever's estimates you believe. Now, originally there were about 2,500 people in this settlement as residents. As I speak, some people are leaving. Literally, there are containers on the street very near to where I'm standing, and people are putting boxes and their furniture in those, and they're moving out. So that population is going down. But as I also said, we have people who've come in here from outside, from Israel, from the West Bank, and they've come here to make a political stand. And they have swollen the population of this place. Basically, their presence has added a certain unpredictable element as to what's going on here in the coming few days. And I think it presents the security forces with a problem as to exactly how they deal with these people. And as I said, because they're highly radicalized, because there are concerns that there could be violent confrontations with the security forces, they're obviously having to take this into account as they carry out this operation.
Are these people mainly who are concerned about Gaza being part of the traditional Jewish homeland, or are they opposed to the pullout on security grounds?
Well, I think they would argue, first and foremost, that Gaza constitutes part of the historic land of Israel, and therefore Israel, the government of Israel, has no right to go in the face of God's will. and it is God's will, they say, that Israel should be here. And then they will throw into the mix also this argument about security. The argument about security normally takes second place. I also think there's another element here, which is, well, if Gaza goes through, maybe something like this could happen on the West Bank. And for these people, the West Bank, many of them, it provides, it's for them, the cradle of Judaism. It provides many of the most important symbols, many most important places for them in Israel, West Bank, Gaza. It's an incredibly important place, and I think that they want to fight this as hard as they can to prove that there's no such thing ever place in the West Bank. And I think they're very determined to make that point here.
We're talking with Richard Myron of the BBC. He is in the West. He is in the Gaza Strip. This is To the Point from PRI. What about the troops themselves? You said you saw some troops that were weeping at the thought of having to evict their countrymen from these settlements. How worried are the officers in the military that not all of their troops will obey their orders?
Well, there's been intensive training on every level. They put them through simulations about how the settlers might act, what they will say to them, how they will try and break down their will. And we saw, first of all, the settlers using the tactics we expected, haranguing the soldiers and policemen, using all types of sort of emotional pressure, psychological pressure, to try and get them not to carry out their orders. I didn't see anybody refusing an order. I did speak to one soldier called Yuri, and I have to say all the soldiers are unarmed in this situation. And he said to me, listen, he said, this is really painful for me. He said, I feel sorry for them, the settlers, but an order is an order, and I've got to carry it out. And this is not a question of my personal feelings or indeed their personal feelings. This is what I've been commanded to do, and I will do it. It's not about expulsion, it's about moving people from one place to the other. So you can see that the security forces here are determined that this should be carried out, and I think the settlers also know this, that whatever they say and do, this is going to go ahead.
With a real confrontation, obviously, coming on Wednesday when they have said that there will be force used. Richard Myron, as always, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Reporting from the Gaza Strip for the BBC. On Reporter's Notebook, the worst drought in the Midwest in 17 years. In a moment, it's down to the wire for Iraq's new constitution. On To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. Iraq is currently governed by a temporary constitution. It stipulates that if a new constitution is not agreed on by midnight tonight, the interim government will go out of existence and new elections will have to be held. The National Assembly was scheduled to meet at 6 o'clock tonight. That was then postponed until 8 o'clock. Then it was postponed again until 10 o'clock just moments ago. There have been reports that an agreement has been reached, but it is at this point difficult to know exactly what the terms of that agreement are. Evidently, there have been, has been reported in the papers in the United States already today, indications that the Shiites and Kurds may come to certain agreements, particularly having to do with autonomy of the northern and southern regions, the Kurdish and Shiite regions, without letting the Sunnis have a voice in this process. The Sunnis are 20 to 30% of the population. They are the ones who have been in charge of the country, certainly were under Saddam Hussein, the ones who are most involved in and thought to be responsible for the increasingly violent insurgency. And there is some concern that if they are not included in the final negotiations about the Constitution, the insurgency could get a lot worse. The timetable calls for there to be an October 15th referendum on the Constitution, if in fact one is passed by the National Assembly. The Sunnis could kill that. They have enough votes in, I believe, 4 of the 18 provinces that they could have a 2/3 rejection of the Constitution in 3 of those provinces. That would cause the Constitution to go down. There would not then presumably be the elections anticipated in December. The United States has been pushing very hard for there to be a resolution by by the deadline of midnight tonight. So far, once again, no indication of whether that situation has been resolved. So we'll start our conversation with Dr. Najee Al-Ali. She is a senior lecturer in social anthropology at the Institute of Arabic and Islamic Studies at the University of Exeter in England. She's a founding member of ACT Together, Women's Action on Iraq. That's a feminist group based in London. And she's author of Gender Secularism and the State in the Middle East, the Egyptian Women's Movement. Dr. Al-Ali, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'm sure that at this point you're not immediately aware of anything more than we are in Iraq, but just in case you are, let me ask you, have you heard anything, talked to anybody in Iraq about what has been agreed to so far?
No, I mean, I have the same information as you, which is still pending. But of course, for those of us who are mainly concerned about the future of Iraqi women, what is mainly at stake, there are two issues that are mainly at stake. One is the role of Islam, and particularly Islamic law with respect to the future constitution. And the second point is the women's quota that was enshrined in the transitional administrative law. As you might recall, there was a 25% quota. And in the new draft constitution, the one that I saw, which was sort of under negotiation, there was an attempt to basically abolish that after the next elections. But I mean, certainly the most important issue is the issue of Islamic law.
The issue of Islamic law. So how do you think women, particularly in Iraq, are thinking about this at the moment? And are they, by a majority of any number, one way or the other on Islamic law?
Well, I would think that the majority of Iraqi women, actually, when asked, either, you know, if you would ask them orally or if they were asked in a referendum, they would say, yes, we want Islamic law, we are Muslims. But the problem is that the majority of women don't know exactly what it would mean in practice. And this is because, you know, no one actually has been able to take the time and effort to explain to women what it would mean. The problem with Islamic law is, and that most people don't realize that, it's not that there's something sort of enshrined in stone. Islamic law is very much open to interpretation, right? So if a relatively liberal or progressive authority, you know, would interpret Islamic law, it might not be bad for women. But there is nothing to actually safeguard conservative person interpreting Islamic law in a restrictive way. Okay. And I should also explain that the reason why the majority of women, if asked today, would say, yes, we want Islamic law, twofold. One reason is that the previous regime, the regime of Saddam Hussein, is very much associated actually with secularism and even with the sort of oppression of religion. Many people don't realize that, but despite the fact that in the 90s, Saddam Hussein very much tried to project himself as a Muslim leader. But in reality, and on the ground, and over the period of 35 years of his dictatorship, he was very much working against religion, and the Ba'ath Party was very much a secular party. So in a way, saying yes to Islam now is a way to try to break with the previous regime. The second reason is that Islam is also perceived as a framework of resistance to Western encroachment and Western imperialism. And people, you know, although people are very happy, I would say the majority are quite happy to get rid of the previous regime, they're not happy about the occupation, they're not happy about Western powers telling them, you know, how they should go ahead. They're worried about impositions of different culture. And so they feel that Islam is the kind of authentic framework in which to express themselves.
Do you have a sense of the role of the United States? It's being reported that U.S. officials are hoping very much that this deadline will be reached tonight, even if some of the most important disagreements have to be postponed in some way. Obviously, the United States wants to see the political process move along. What's your feeling about that? What about the postponement of this issue like of Islamic law, and would that be a good idea?
Well, you know, this is the problem with you know, this kind of interpretation of democracy. I mean, it's very difficult for me to think of this as a democratic process if at the end of the day, 15th of October, there is a vote, which is wonderful, you know, if Iraqis can vote on it. But what does a vote mean if it's not an educated vote? I was recently in Amman, and I talked to Iraqi women who were visiting Amman from Iraq, but also some who are living in Amman. And I asked them, you know, what do you think about the constitution? What do you think about Islamic law? And I should say that many of the women I talked to didn't even care less or didn't know about the whole process of constitution, because if you're living in Iraq right now, you have very different concerns. You know, you worry about electricity, you worry about the lack of water, you worry about the lack of security. You don't worry about the constitution. Okay, but that doesn't make it less important, because, you know, when electricity comes back, if security comes back, people will be stuck with the constitution. And then when I asked them, yeah, well, what do you think about Islamic law? And they said, yeah, well, why not? But then I asked them concrete questions. I asked them, for example, how would you feel about your husband being able to marry another wife without asking for your permission? And they would say, no, of course I wouldn't want that. How would you feel about having to ask permission or travel with a male guardian inside Iraq? No, of course I wouldn't want that. It was very clear that although, you know, they sort of embraced the general idea of it, but in terms of possible practical implications, they really didn't want that. And so, I mean, for me, I feel it is very important that before there is a referendum, that people inside Iraq will have a chance to understand what it might entail.
Again, Dr. Naji Al-Ali is senior lecturer at the University of Exeter in London, very active in the feminist movement there and with regard to Iraq as well. We will come back to her in a moment. First, I want to go to Michael O'Hanlon, who's senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. Michael O'Hanlon, welcome to you.
Thanks, Warren.
Another issue that has been very important, apparently the one that has been the most problematic over the past couple of days, and that has to do with what's referred to as federalism. What do we mean by that?
The question, in a nutshell, really, I think, is as in the United States, how much power do the states have, or in Iraq's case, the provinces, and how much power is in the hands of the central government? And that can be everything from security to negotiations with neighbors about trade agreements to, of course, the distribution of oil revenue, which I think may be the single most important point.
Okay, oil revenue, the oil being mostly in the Kurdish north and the Shiite south, and very recently the Shiites have asked for the kind of autonomy that it has been apparent the Kurds were going to get. What sort of problems has that caused?
Well, I'm hugely worried about this, and your previous guest was extraordinarily eloquent and most admirable, and I share her concerns about Iraq's constitution over the longer term. But in the short term, I think the oil revenue issue is number one, especially for Iraqis, but also for the United States, because I fear that if that's not well handled, the insurgency could get worse. The reason being, the Sunni Arabs stand to lose because of the dynamic you've just described, where if the Kurds and the Shia get autonomy, for them, autonomy may also mean a lot of the oil revenue produced in their province. Maybe 60, 70, 80%, who knows what number they would aim for. The Kurds may want the option someday of seceding and taking all the oil and all the revenue. And what that means is the Sunni Arabs could be left essentially in a ghettoized portion of western Iraq with very few resources, mediocre farmland, and a greater feeling of betrayal and of embitterment. And that could lead to more support for the insurgency and possibly even a civil war.
Earlier we heard Dr. Al-Ali suggest that it might be better to postpone some of these questions, particularly the one having to do with Islam and women's rights, because it will be so difficult to educate the populace before the election on October 15th. What about this issue? Is this one that also, in your opinion, Michael O'Hanlon, ought to be postponed?
Well, Warren, I don't claim to have the kind of feel for it that a negotiator would who's on the scene or for one of the Iraqi politicians, but my instinct is to say no, that this is exactly the kind of thing you have to resolve or you don't really have a deal in the first place, that if the Constitution is going to mean anything, it has to begin to protect the Sunni Arab rights on this question. Because if I'm a Sunni Arab, I'm going to assume that I'm going to lose this issue in the future unless I get some protection right now in the Constitution. After all, the Kurds and the Shia control 80% of the votes in Iraq, and they control or are represented by an even higher percentage of the current parliament because the Sunni Arab turnout was so low on the January 30th election. So what does not happen in the Constitution could happen very easily and quickly in the legislative process, with the Sunni Arabs having no ability to prevent it. So if I'm a Sunni Arab, I am going to insist on the oil revenue issue being handled in the Constitution, or I'm going to feel like the whole process has probably been a farce.
Michael O'Hanlon, a senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. This is To the Point from PRI. Peter Galbraith is a senior diplomatic fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, former ambassador to Croatia. Currently, he is in Baghdad monitoring the situation there. And Mr. Ambassador, thank you for joining us.
Warren, good to be with you again.
You just heard, I'm sure, from Michael O'Hanlon, his concern that if, in fact, autonomy goes to both the Kurds and the Shiites, that raises the possibility of civil war because the Sunnis will be, in his term, ghettoized. What are your concerns?
Well, the issue is not granting the Kurds autonomy. They already have a de facto independent state, and they aren't going to give it up. Even if somehow a compromise could be forged in this constitution, it will certainly be rejected by the population in Kurdistan, which voted 98% in a referendum in January for independence. The Shiites have comparable demand, and they're the majority in the country, so they're in a position to enforce theirs. I think that the fact is that a loose federation is probably the best protection for the Sunnis, who otherwise risk being dominated by the Shiites. And the core problem of Iraq, as we've discussed before, is there really isn't a part of the population that feels that is Iraqi. People identify themselves by Kurds, Sunni, Shiites.
Well, how is it that a loose federation would be any protection at all for the Sunnis if the Kurds are going to be able to have their oil revenues and the Shiites will be able to control theirs?
Well, the issue of oil revenues is different from the issue of whether there should be federal units. So that goes to the question of how they should be financed. Now, there is not a successful federation in the world where the constituent components do not have their own source of revenue. So if the federalism is to work in Iraq, both the Kurds and the Shiites are going to have to control the oil resources. But there also has to be a vehicle under which these revenues are shared among the Sunnis and those parts of the country that don't have oil. I'm talking to you about 20 feet from where the negotiations are taking place, and I've been talking to the parties all night. This is certainly one of the extremely difficult issues, but over the question of who owns the oil and who manages it, but there's no disagreement about the idea that the revenues should be shared both with the federal government and with the regions. Everybody agrees on that, and everybody agrees that the formula more or less should be per capita.
All right, Peter Galbraith, standing as he indicated, 20 feet from where the negotiations are taking place. We want to know what we can find out from him about those negotiations, not just on this issue, but some of the others we've discussed as well, certainly about the question of Islamic law and the protection of women's rights. We'll come back in a moment to talk about all of those things. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, the American Midwest in its worst dry spell since 1988. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Mormon Alney back with To the Point. As we speak, it is about 10:30 in the evening in Baghdad, Iraq, just an hour and a half from the constitutional deadline for forming a new constitution. Peter Galbraith is just outside the negotiating area there, where the National Assembly was scheduled to meet, its meetings having been postponed several times already this evening. Once again, he's a senior diplomatic fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation and former ambassador to Croatia. Ambassador, what can you tell us about the negotiations themselves?
Well, first, they're not taking place at the National Assembly. Ah. All the leaders are gathered here, which is the headquarters of Masoud Barzani, the president of the Kurdistan region. who's serving as the host of these talks. You have all the leaders here, as well as the American ambassador and his staff, who are busy working the room. At the moment, there's a meeting just of the very top leaders of the major political groupings. It's clear that, barring a miracle, they will not meet the deadline. There will not be a draft that will be approved by the National Assembly in the next hour and a half. And technically, therefore, the National Assembly will be dissolved. There's no mechanism to extend the National Assembly under the TAL, except an amendment which would require three-quarters, and I don't think that's going to happen tonight. Now, there may in the end be some effort to fudge it, but I think the fact is the deadline has been missed.
So what does that mean then, do you think, and where particularly does that leave the United States, which has been pushing very hard for the deadline to be met?
Well, President Bush made a huge gamble when he insisted on the 15th of August deadline, and he may end up losing that gamble. The problem here, you know, the reason it's so difficult, is the three groups simply don't have they don't have shared values. They don't have a shared idea of Iraq. The Shiites define themselves in religious terms. They'd like to impose an Islamic state. The Kurds almost unanimously don't want to be part of Iraq at all. So it's extremely hard to find common ground. But there are also people who have a limited experience in these kinds of negotiations. The process has been poorly organized. There are mechanical problems of producing drafts. There's been zero public input into the process. It's being done behind closed doors. So even if something emerges in the next few days, having missed the deadline, not being in certainly technical violation of the TAL, it may not have a lot of legitimacy among the various peoples of Iraq. That's a potential problem.
Again, Peter Galbraith in Baghdad, former ambassador to Croatia, now with the Center for Arms Control and Non-Proliferation. Also in Baghdad, covering the story is Alyssa Rubin. She is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. And Alyssa, thank you very much for being with us. Have Iraqis addressed the possibility of not being able to meet the constitutional deadline? And if so, what can you tell us about their thoughts about it?
Well, I think at the moment the public expectation has been that the leaders will come up with a constitution, and people aren't really discussing what would happen if they didn't. And certainly no one is talking about that in practical real terms. I mean, the Iraq wouldn't come to an end without a constitution, and there could be laws passed that would allow the country to go on and government ministries to function. But I don't think, as Ambassador Galbraith said, that there is much understanding of what's even in the Constitution or what's at stake. I've talked to a number of Iraqis. I was just in a Sunni neighborhood tonight. I just got back, where people really they're not even really clear of what the deadline is. I mean, they now are aware, if they're in Baghdad, that there were negotiations that were going on that are about to end, but they're kind of unclear if then there's a draft or then there's a finished product, and what it is that happens on October 15th, is that really the deadline? It's all a muddle, because there hasn't been much aggressive public education. There's a small political class that understands it. So I think for Iraqis, this will just feel like one more marker of kind of the chaos that has become their lives here.
What does that mean for their attitude toward the coalition forces, and particularly the U.S., which has put together this process, as Ambassador Galbraith just remarked?
Well, I guess I think that people's views of the U.S. are pretty much shaped by the past couple of years, and the Constitution won't change it one way or the other, particularly. I mean, people have responded to the way in which either the fact that they were very oppressed and abused and persecuted under Saddam Hussein, the Kurds and the Shiites, and then they have a somewhat more benign view of the Americans, or if they are Sunnis and they lost their power, they resent it deeply, and they concentrate on everything that's going wrong and don't give any allowances for or some of the more entrenched problems that were here before and that have some of them worsened and some of them changed and all that. So I'm not sure that this will redound one way or the other to the Americans. I think for the Americans, it will be, if they really don't have a constitution or they don't meet the deadline in some fashion, that they can at least present as a sort of an accomplishment. I think that raises more questions for them in terms of whether they can. The administration has talked a lot about how Iraqis always meet their deadlines. If they don't, this will be a significant miss because of the way the sort of achievements have been set out by the Americans.
And does that mean then that to the extent that there's any sort of timetable at all, which the administration, of course, says there is not, that would be set back if the Constitution and these other political decisions can't be made on schedule?
Well, it certainly puts it in considerable upheaval, and it does leave the appearance of a vacuum of power for some period of time, and that proved to be a very fruitful situation or circumstance for the insurgency back in the period when the government was forming after the election. There was a very long period when the Iraqi government was coming together, ministers were being appointed, the prime minister was being chosen, and that was a very fertile period for the insurgency. So I think if you don't have a constitution and you don't have a sense of forward motion, it is an opening for more insurgent activity. But I can't say that even if there was a constitution, there wouldn't be, that would somehow halt the insurgent activity, but I just think that it will be even more of a stimulus if there's a sense of uncertainty and some confusion and chaos.
Okay, and again, what I meant by referring to the timetable, of course, has to do with the ultimate withdrawal of American troops as well. Let me go back to Michael O'Hanlon, the senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. You said you were very concerned, regardless of what ordinary Iraqis might know about this constitution, about resolving this question of leaving the Sunnis without sufficient finances if there's a loose federation of the sort Ambassador Galbraith talks about with the oil revenues, then a separate issue, of course, but nonetheless implied being divided between the North and the South. Are you sufficiently concerned, Michael O'Hanlon, that you'd use that you'd suggest there's a possibility of civil war?
I think there is if the Sunni Arabs don't have their rights protected in a fundamental way. And I do really think that the autonomy issue is largely inseparable, or at least very hard to separate from the oil revenue allocation issue. And while I would be delighted to have the kind of confederation Ambassador Galbraith has laid out, if indeed, of course, the Sunni Arabs would accept that, I find it very hard to see how you can do that and still make their part of Iraq a viable place economically. And therefore, I don't think you're going to get their support in the end. And there are different ways for groups to be upset. You know, you can be upset because you didn't get the best outcome. You can also be so mad that you see your fundamental interests jeopardized and be willing to go to war over them. And there are going to be a lot of disagreements and a lot of people upset and needing to compromise. And that's understandable. But what I'm most worried about is a fundamental attack on the interests of one group or another through the way in which the Constitution is devised. And that's what I'm afraid we're at risk of doing or seeing others do to the Sunni Arabs on the oil allocation issue. And I hope very much I'm wrong. Ambassador Galbraith is about 7,000 miles closer to the talks than I am. But frankly, they seem to have a deal over the weekend and it fell apart. So I am not going to count this chicken before it's hatched.
Mr. Galbraith, your response, you've talked about the possibility of civil war on this program before, but I think you were mostly concerned about the Kurds. What about what we just heard from Michael O'Hanlon?
Well, there was a deal over the weekend on the oil revenues in which a part of the oil revenues would be owned and managed by the regions, a part of the oil, and another part by the federal government. That then was torpedoed by the Shiites after they had agreed to it. Now, on the issue of a civil war, I think it's important to understand that there already is a civil war in Iraq. It is going on between Sunnis and Shiites. For those who are familiar with the Balkans, there are many aspects that are familiar. There are killings. There is ethnic cleansing. And it is very much intensifying. The Kurds largely have stayed out of it, although there is something of this going on between Kurds and Arabs in Mosul. Each of these regions have their own security forces. The Iraqi army is not a national army. It is Kurdish in Kurdistan and loyal to the Kurdistan government, not to Baghdad. It is Sunni in the center. It is Shiite in the south and loyal to the clerics. The country, it's not a question of granting autonomy. It is already broken apart. And trying to put it back together is not feasible. I think one has to play out the scenarios. Suppose you did actually get a more centralized constitution. It would be rejected by Kurdistan, clearly. Then what happens after October 15th? What happens to the process when a constitution actually has been rejected? I think it may well be that this process will not be successfully concluded either tonight or if there's some kind of continuation of it. There'll be new elections, the Sunnis will participate, and then there'll be very little chance of reaching a constitution, which might not be a bad result. I mean, we Americans, attach great importance to our constitution, but other countries operate without them. And if you don't have a constitution, you don't have to deal with the kind of fundamental issues like who owns the oil that are raised on a constitution. Those can be worked out practically as they have been over the past year.
Peter Galbraith, again, a former ambassador to Croatia, now in Baghdad, very close, as he put it earlier, 20 feet away from where the conversations are going on now, not at the National Assembly. They haven't reached that level as yet. Perhaps, according to him, they may not be able to do that the hour and 15 minutes that they have left for that process. Let me go back to Alyssa Rubin with the Los Angeles Times. What are American military people saying at this point, and the ambassador as well? If, in fact, the agreement can't be made, how are they going to spin that, if I can ask that kind of a question? Have they thought about that? Have they anticipated that possibility?
Well, my impression from the last certainly the last few days, even the last week, is that they really haven't considered that at all, and they've been very confident that there would be an agreement. And I think to some extent that was perhaps borrowing from past experiences elsewhere, and even from some officials' experience in Washington, where it's very common that people go right up to midnight or right into the early hours of the morning, and then at the penultimate moment they reach a deal. But this is really quite different, and this is people here are deciding basically the future, their future, if they're Shiites, Kurds, or Sunnis, and so there's a huge amount at stake. There's no way to come back at the whole thing next year, you know, which is what you can do certainly in Washington on almost anything. So I think there may have been a bit of a miscalculation about the certainty here, and also possibly the level of adamancy by these different groups. I mean, there's increasing feeling in the south and southern Iraq and even south central Iraq by Shia that they sort of have a right to their own state, and a lot there's been very frequent comments in the past few days, especially that they should not have less than the Kurds, and that's a very strong statement, and I would have thought that the Americans might have been concerned that perhaps that signaled that there might not be so much flexibility. But they didn't seem to feel that way. As you recall, just yesterday there were lots of comments on, I think Ambassador Khalilzad was on many, many television shows with great confidence that there would be a deal today, and I don't think they know exactly how they'll spin this.
Again, Alyssa Rubin is reporting from Baghdad for the Los Angeles Times. Very quickly, I want to go back to Dr. Naji Al-Ali. She has been waiting patiently on our program since speaking to us at the very outset about the question of Islamic law and women's rights. And I'm just interested to ask you, Dr. Al-Ali, from your position now in London, earlier Ambassador Galbraith suggested it might be okay if Iraq didn't have a constitution. Do you feel, given your concerns about the level of education in the electorate, especially among women, that it might be just as well if there weren't a referendum by October 15th?
Well, I'm not sure about that, to tell you the truth, but I would like to add something else, which I've made me feel very uncomfortable. I mean, as someone of Iraqi origin, of Iraqi Shia origin with family in Iraq, I feel very uncomfortable about the fact that all of your speakers, in one way or another, really reified the divisions between Shia, Sunni, and Kurds, and portrayed the Shia as a group that wants, wants a religious state, and the Kurds don't, and the Sunni don't. I mean, it's much more complex than that. I mean, what this kind of depiction totally ignores the fact that, there is a class issue as well. I mean, if you're a Shia middle class in Baghdad, you share much more with your middle class Sunni or Kurdish neighbor than the downtrodden Shia in Sadr City or in the south. Or the fact that many of the middle class population in Baghdad or the other urban centers are actually mixed families. I mean, there's this joke in Iraq, sushis, I mean, mixed Sunni and Shia families. And the fact that there are many Shias who don't want a religious state, and the fact that many Sunnis want a religious state, I feel very uncomfortable with the way the outside, I mean, particularly the United States, simplifies matters. That is not to say that there are not real divisions there. They are, of course. But they're not just across sort of ethnic and religious lines. They are also very much across class lines and, you know, profession. And also Baghdad is quite different from the rest of the country. And I guess the other point that I'd like to stress is, you know, in my mind, you know, whether this constitution will be agreed on today or later, or whether there will be a constitution or not, it's very clear to me that the biggest loser in all of what's been happening are going to be women. And this is in a context where the United States and the United Kingdom has been, you know, saying that we're going to bring democracy and human rights to a country. I mean, for those of us who know the fact that Iraqi women were amongst the most educated in the region in the 70s and 80s, despite dictatorship, despite political oppression, I think it's very sad and it's symbolic for wider issues.
Well, thank you very much for that perspective, and let me invite you to come back on future programs, Dr. Naji Al-Ali, and thank you for joining us today from England. We're glad to have you with us. I want to issue the same invitation to our other guests, Michael O'Hanlon at the Brookings Institution, Peter Galbraith at the Arms Control and Nonproliferation Center, now currently in Baghdad, and also, of course, to Alyssa Rubin of the Los Angeles Times. Thanks very much to all of you, and once again, we will see what happens as the deadline passes and what happens next in Iraq. This is To the Point from PRI. From eastern Texas all the way to Wisconsin, 5 months of drought have led to smaller harvests of corn and soybeans. The shortage of rain also means that rivers crucial to inland transportation are approaching their all-time low levels. More on that in a moment on the worst drought in the Midwest in 17 years on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Werman Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The central United States hasn't been this dry since 1988, and there's concern that the mighty Mississippi might drop as low as the record of 6.3 feet set back in 1940. That's according to Martin van der Werf, who's a business columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And Martin, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
6.3 feet, that doesn't sound very deep for the Mississippi. What would that mean to the barges and the other kinds of ships that go up and down?
Well, it basically means that traffic would stop because the boats that push the barges and pull the barges need about 8 feet of draw. So they basically would be stranded until dams and locks up the river could release enough water to keep certain pools of water flowing. It would basically reduce traffic to a trickle.
And what would that mean for the economy of the Midwest?
Well, it would mean that agricultural products would not be able to get downriver, and that would be very hard on the farmers who are already suffering from the drought conditions. It also would make it harder to push things like coal down the river, and the coal is what powers the power plants, many of which are located on the river, because of the ease of getting coal to them, and it also removes them from population centers.
When you say that the produce wouldn't get down the river and the farmers would be in trouble, what about the people that are waiting for the produce?
Well, prices would go up. There wouldn't be a lot to do until it could get down river.
So what would people have then to go without?
Well, for the most part, you know, obviously what they're growing in the Midwest is grains, primarily corn, soybeans, that sort of thing in this area. Over further to the west, of course, wheat. But wheat travels less on the river than the corns and the soybeans do.
So corn, a major crop in that part of the world, and does a lot of things besides feed people. Just give us an indication, as a business columnist, about how important corn is to everything from pig food to ethanol.
Well, you know, unfortunately, what's happening here this year is that, I'm happy to report that it's actually raining. I'm looking through the window right now. It's raining in St. Louis. Wow, it's big news. But unfortunately, a lot of the corn crop has already been lost for this year, and a lot of it, unfortunately, for the farmers, is going to be turned right into silage. That is pig food. It has just not been a good year because the rains did not come when they were needed. And so for people who had record corn crops last year, they're going to have a rather trying year this year. And if they're not going to be looking to their own pocket to pay it off, they're going to be looking to their insurance company on crop insurance. So it's going to be a difficult, difficult year for corn farmers. This rain has come in at a very good time, actually, and hopefully it keeps on going on for the soybean farmers because it's a critical time for the soybeans.
Now, the corn has already flowered, and it's in the process of being harvested, but the soybeans are still in an earlier stage. Is that right?
Yeah, well, the corn should be in harvest right around now, but a lot of it is just withered and died in the fields, and it's going to be plowed under, or what can be harvested, they'll just probably turn much of it into silage. As far as the soybeans are harvested later, and this is the time of the year when the peas are developing in the pod. So rain now is actually very helpful, and if it continues, it could still save much of the crop.
So obviously you're happy to see this rain. How much rain, though, is it going to take? Is there enough to rescue the corn crop, or is it too late for that?
It's in a lot of areas, particularly northern Illinois and across a lot of Missouri, it's too late really for the corn crop. A lot of it has just been written off. We've been getting quite a bit. We got quite a bit of rain over the weekend. We got a very heavy thunderstorm on Saturday in the St. Louis area. In western Missouri, it rained for 2 days straight. So we're getting quite a bit of rain. So, you know, those of us who wrote drought stories, that would be me last week. I think the fact that we wrote them precipitated the rain. But it seemed like a big story at the time. It seems like less of a story now, although the rain is not especially widespread, and it's supposed to end after today. So the farmers, especially the soybean farmers, really need it to rain one or two more good soakings to really save their crop or to at least produce a better crop than they're going to be able to produce right now.
What states so far have been the most impacted by this?
Well, Illinois has been the hardest hit, actually. There's a swath of, say, north-central Illinois that is considered to be an extreme drought. Missouri has been pretty hard hit across most of the state, except for the far northwest corner. And those are the states that have been the most hit. There are parts of Oklahoma and Kansas that have had pretty severe droughts. Iowa's been better off.
What about the federal government? Do the states get any assistance there, or is that way down the road after a long and difficult process?
It's a ways down the road yet before they would declare a crop emergency or a crop loss. I think that actually occurs once they start getting reports of the harvest, and those reports aren't really in yet.
So I guess among the things that this dramatizes is the extraordinary instability of trying to farm. You said last year there were record corn crops,
yep.
And this year it's looking terrible. I suppose in a way, to the extent that last year's crop is stored, they're competing against themselves.
That's true. Last year was a very mild summer. There was periodic rain throughout the summer. This year has been a very hot summer, and there's been virtually no rain. And for those people who can't get water out into the fields, and with a crop like corn, generally you're at the mercy of the elements. You don't usually water it a lot. And so it's just the vagaries of the weather.
Back to the question of the rivers, the Mississippi and others. You're there in St. Louis, right on the Mississippi River. Does it already look different? Are there fewer boats out there, or are they trying to move as many as fast as they can just in case the levels fall anymore?
Well, I know that, for example, the river's been falling so much that actually some sunken ships are starting to surface.
Um,
it's uh, it's actually quite treacherous in places, especially right around the St. Louis area, where they dredge a main channel, but they don't dredge some tributaries and in some hollows. And so some sunken ships have begun to surface in the St. Louis area. It actually does look quite a bit different. I mean, just with a naked eye, you can tell it's down quite a bit. Of course, it's brown, as always, but it looks quite a bit different. You can see there's some places on the sides of the river that you're seeing that you haven't seen in quite a long time. The river is up slightly because of the rain. It is up about 2 feet, and in some cases up near 3 feet in the St. Louis area just over the weekend.
So the fluctuations then occur pretty rapidly.
Yeah, they really do. It depends to some degree on what they're doing with the locks upriver. But they've had to close part of the Mississippi River up near Rock Island, Illinois, because of dredging. It was closed for about 3 days last week. Also, part of the Ohio River was closed for dredging last week, too. So there have been some real deleterious effects because of the low riverfall lately.
All right. Life in the Midwest, a sometime thing. Martin Vanderwerf of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Business columnist. Today's program produced by Jonah King with Kristen Bordahl and Karen Radziner, technical director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.